Toymaker. The Leith police dismisseth us. It's 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. Have you got somewhere safe to hide? You're in the shed, guts churning and palms sweating as you set up the run that Gav's put on you for tomorrow. It's all the fault of that fucking cunt down at the Cash for No Questions shop on Leith Walk. He wouldn't offer you more than €50 for the telly, even though you could show him a receipt all legal-like to prove it wasn't hot. And he wouldn't even look at your Moby or your bike. And the thing is, unless you get your hands on 3 large by Tuesday, you're getting malked. You owe the operations tax farmer €300 for services rendered, and the operation Disney take. No, you ken I got knocked back by the bastard what bought it, for an answer. Nor does the operation play well with a big boy did it and ran away. The dog ate my homework, or pay you next Tuesday. The operation's approach to dealing with intellectual property violations is drastic and memorable. You've seen the vid of that yin from Birmingham what crossed them. Even signed a fucking contract on paper to say you kent what you was getting into. Fact is, you're their Faber franchisee for Pilrig, and if ye couldn't keep afloat to cover your credit, ye shouldn't have fucking signed the piece of paper, ye ken. It's nae your fault you're hard up. There's a recession on. You're long on feedstock, and your car got crushed because you couldn't afford the insurance after that epi bastard Tony and his fucking jakey friend ripped off your stash right after you paid the overdue council tax. It was that, or they were going to send the sheriff's court officers round. That would never do if them cunts keeked what you'd hid in the shed. And then fucking Big Malk gouged you for 3 days' fab time and gave you a gubbing when you asked to be paid. None of which matters, like, say, the operation's going to have their half kilo of flesh. The shed at the back of your mum's house is cramped, dark and dingy, surrounded by thigh-high grass and weeds landmined with cat shit from the feral tom what lives next door. You took it over after your old man died, chucked the rusting lawnmower and ran a mains extension out the kitchen window. That, and drilled through the brickwork under the sink and plumbed in a water hose. The fab needs water and power, and special feedstock and lots of 'em. Like an old-time cannabis farm back before they decriminalised it. You tiled the shed roof with stolen polymer PV slates, not that they're good for much this far north of Moscow, and installed shelves to hold your feedstock supplies and spares. It took you a year to scrimp and cadge and steal the parts you needed to bootstrap the Hingmy. You could have saved for half that long and bought a shiny wee one in John Lewis with the DRM and the spyware to stop you making what you will. But if you'd gone down that road, no way would the toymaker take you on. Which leaves you needing 3 big in 4 days and nowhere to turn but Gav. Not that there's aught wrong with the colour of Gav's money, but he's of a kind with Big Malk. A local businessman, higher up the food chain than most of the Neds round these parts. There's something of the knight about him, and the way he fucking grins without showing his teeth creeps you out, like he's fucking Dracula, like, say. And what Gav wants you to make for him, you really didn't want to get dragged into that stuff. You could get lifted for this shit, eat some serious prison time, and all for 3 big. The fucking fuck! There's a dump down in Seafield with a sideline in homogeneous graded sinter process metal powders, a grocery store that sells interesting polymers disguised as bags of bread flour, cheap no-name pay-as-you-go data sticks and VPN software that disguises the traffic as noise overlaid on fake voice channels. This stuff isn't rocket science anymore. It's not hacking anymore. It's just illegal as hell because it pisses off the money. The Lord Disney appreciate the likes of you schemey scum, like the nice security man called you between the second and third drive teasing, that time they caught you shoplifting in the St. James Quarter. The law specially doesn't like your kind owning 3D printers, fabbers capable of taking a design template off a pirate website somewhere and extruding it into the real world to an accuracy of a few microns. The good law-abiding folks, they're welcome to run off roll plugs and coffee coasters and plastic Nessie tat for their weans, but the police don't like unmonitored fabs. They could be making anything. Plastic chibs that dinna show up on metal detectors, meth lab in a brick solid-state drug labs, homebrew handguns, or what Gav's buying. Here's the photos, Gav told you in his flat English accent. He seemed to savour the words. 15 shots each of the subject. He slid an ancient memory stick across the tabletop towards you, its surface rubbed down to anonymous white plastic by age. You made it disappear hastily. Stitch 'em up and render the parts to scale. There's a model there. It needs to be ready by Sunday night. Mozzie will pick it up and pay you at 6 sharp. Eh, but you ken it's a big load of work. It'll take 24 hours to fab 'em, like, say. So, you'd better get started, like, say. You bite your tongue. He's taking the pish, but the way he smiles tells you he kens he's got your number. Cunt. Gav's buying on behalf of someone who'll be really embarrassed if his habit comes out. That you can tell. The stick feels like it's burning a hole in your pocket as you walk home from the pub. The job's simple enough, but if they catch you with it... Someone's been naughty with their phone. They've been taking pictures. Innocent enough, and they've been careful. No upskirt perv service shots that might tip the police off. But once they've got enough angles, it's over to you, via Gav. There's software that'll stitch together a polygon map from a bunch of images, working out the perspectives and textures from all the angles. And once you've got the skin, you can drop it over the model of a doll and send it to the printer, which'll generate the pieces of a hard plastic skeleton surrounded by textured, colourised, soft plastic skin that the customer can squeeze and suck without any risk of screaming or telling, ready to clip together around servo motors to animate and sensors to react. And the beauty of it is that she'll never know, this 4-year-old whose animatronic double is going to star in some pedo's sex life. Well, it's no light you can ask Gav, and anyway, you need his money. Otherwise, you won't be able to pay off the operation. The fab's still warm from that Bampot Malks job, so you start by stuffing fresh cans of feedstock up its arse. This job's a hybrid, multiple plastics in the same structure and a skeleton made using the special brew that's been doing the rounds these past couple of months. The workspace is clean and there's no crap lying around from the last run, which is good, and it's big enough that if you twist the model just so, you can make it in one run. So, you cable your laptop up to the fab, stick your special dongle in its side, swipe your thumbprint across it for access, and log in to Evil Santa's workshop to download the templates for a bad night out in Toy Town. Early afternoon. You blink yourself awake in gritty-eyed confusion, stirring from sleep on the living room sofa. You're surrounded by the detritus of a chaotic Saturday night. Greasy pizza box upside down on the carpet. Empty tinnies of Jiviet super rolled under the TV console, game controller dumped in the ashtray in a confusion of doubts. You swear under your breath, Jesus, fuck. You didn't get to bed in the end. Microwave pizza and cheap Polish beer fueled you on an epic raid in Axe Cop 14. You and the Grease Street gang tooled up on what's left of your stash of Provigil and chopped 7 shades of shit out of the baby panda squad in return for... 4. Shite! It's 3 o'fucking clock in the afternoon. Yon cunt Mozzie's going to be round in a couple of hours. The fucking fab's going to be chapping its heart out. Feed me, clean me, the usual after-job shoe-shaggy it insists on. You gotta get the cargo bagged up and the hell out of your hoose in case that fat twat Mozzie scalps you. You're going to plant them underneath an abandoned car in a back alley somewhere. Demand the money up front and return for directions, like, say. Not good to be caught out the same way twice. You roll off the soiled sofa, gurning, and stagger out to the lavvy. The kicking glass shows you an orc with eyes like red-rimmed pistols and a block of lard. Jaxie, this is your life. Loser, tosser, fab monkey to the gentry of the night, it's our there. You look away hastily, stumble out and through the grimy kitchen to the back door and the shed. The shed! You open the door and step inside. First up, you ken it smells wrong. Fabbers have their ain smell, not humming like but a goosh of hot plastic and metal. When it's working hard plastic, there's a lot of hot metal and steam from the chiller circuit. This is like all soft placky, which is wrong. So you hit the light switch. Something's gone very wrong with your fabber. The red supply blinking lights are pulsing manically across its front, and the lid's come open. Not only that, it's rising on a fucking pillar of multicoloured hingmas, pushing their way out of the extrusion cell like a loaf of bread that's risen too far. Fuck the fucking fuckers fucked! You grab the handle on the lid. A lime-green hingmy pops up at you, and you clock what it is, and that's when you realise that, no, the fucking fucker isn't fucked. It's you what's fucked. The evidence is all over the screen of your lappy, which, fucking idiot that you are, you left online when you went inside last night. You grab the lime-green plastic dildo. It's an anatomically correct cock, but it's the wrong colour, only about 8 centimetres long, and there's something embossed on it, a URL. As you squint at it, another wee plastic cock, this one cherry red, topples off the mound that's rising from the fabber's guts and bounces across the floor. Jesus fuck! You stare at the lappy in horror. About 60 dozen overlapping windows are warning you that spyware has been detected, inviting you to download an antivirus package from the app store of a fly-by-night scamware vendor in Hainan. You ken it's the same site as the URL on the dildo. Jesus fuck, you repeat. It's ransomware, pure and simple. The Doug ate my homework. Never mind Gav and his minions. Tomorrow you're going to meet the operations tax farmer who expects you to pay up for your key to the dark gates of Toyland. 27 hours to lay your hands on 3 large. You are so fucked.
Hello. We interrupt your scheduled browsing to bring you news of an unfortunate incident. Stuart Jackson, aged 22, a resident of Hamilton Wynd, Leith, has just visited our local business development executive, the Toymaker. That would be me. To plead for assistance in restructuring his debt. Perhaps you're thinking that the operation is unduly harsh in its treatment of defaulters. and it's possible you have some sneaking sympathy for Jaxie, a secondary school dropout struggling to make his way in a cruel and bewildering world that has written him off as being of no conceivable value. Well, you'd be wrong. This vale of tears we live in holds a virtually unending supply of Jaxes, eager Neds ready and willing to sell crack to their grannies and jack their neighbors' laptops to pay for the next bottle of Bucky. Jaxie is distinguished from the rest of them solely by a modicum of low cunning, a propensity for graft, and a minor eye for space-filling structure that, if he'd applied himself to his standards and baccalaureate, might have found him a place on the rolls of a distance learning institution, and ultimately a ladder up to what passes for a respectable, middle-class profession in this degraded age of outsourcing. But Jaxie is lazy. Jaxie Disney enjoy the learning. Jaxie is a petty criminal who pays his way by acting as an outlet for the toymaker's bottom-tier products. And Jaxie slept through his economics classes in school. As you have doubtless realized by now, the operations products are all illegal. This imposes certain regrettable cost externalities on us. You can't buy insurance and police protection for your business if what you manufacture ranges from MDMA labs to clitoridectomy kits. We've learned over the years that it's necessary to take a stern but honest line with junior franchisees who ask for business development capital loans, then default on their line of credit. In our world of unregulated free market enterprise, there is no society to offload business externalities like insurance onto, no courts to settle disputes equitably, and no presumption of goodwill. We have given Jaxie every opportunity to pay off his debt on time. We even steered business his way, when he was too lazy to get on his bike and look for work, by way of our local salesman, Gav. Despite having a suitable contract dropped in his lap, Jaxie still managed to drag defeat from the jaws of victory. This is the point at which our patience would normally be exhausted. We are not a welfare scheme, and we cannot afford to continually make allowances for incompetence when it impacts the bottom line. But Jax's debt is not substantial. Furthermore, we're aware that he is willing and eager to repay it, and would certainly have done so on time had not the Doug ate my homework. We're therefore pleased to announce that we are going to exercise the prerogative of mercy on this occasion. Jaxie, we hope you'll take this punishment, which is intended to teach you a valuable lesson in the spirit in which it is intended. It may strike you as unpleasant and draconian, but consider the alternatives. We have a franchise relationship model to defend. As it is, your punishment will not hurt much. You'll make a full recovery, and it won't even impair your ability to continue in your chosen profession. Just don't fuck up and make us come for your other kidney. Liz, morning after. Wednesday morning starts out moist and grey in that way Edinburgh gets in summer, when the Haar comes boiling up from the Firth and fills the streets with a humid Whitechapel haze, misting your specs and clogging your lungs like a stifling blanket. You find yourself thinking about work over breakfast, a couple of cereal bars and a half litre of apple juice. Work is both a relief and a distraction. It beats sitting and staring at the walls, aimlessly surfing the net, or grocery shopping, all activities that leave you twitchy and numb, vulnerable to the little existential doubts that nibble at your willpower when you don't have a focus. Besides, you've got a nice little bundle of puzzles on your desktop, your own investigation caseload, plus trouble tickets escalated by your team because they're not amenable to a 5-minute clean-up.
If you lose yourself in the in-tray, time passes that bit more quickly. So it is that after breakfast you pull on a clean suit, grab your bag, and head for the gym. And after a brisk half-hour workout and a shower, you catch a microbus to the station. While you're waiting at the bus stop, expect 5 minutes between vehicles, according to the flickering sign, more like 10 if you account for traffic jams, you put on your specs and log into the daily news flow. Surprise! Dodgy Dickie McLeish has got an ops room up and running for last night's case, and he wants you to check in. Kibitzing on a Charlie Hotel investigation, culpable homicide, CH to its friends, isn't exactly going to contribute to your team performance metrics, but it's a higher priority job than most, and it's a whiff of the unusual. So you hurry on down to briefing room D31, grabbing a coffee on the way. Police briefing rooms haven't changed much over the years. They retain the same scuffed white paint, checkerboard-fading LED panel lighting, and cheap furniture. The spoor of an institution focused on results, not appearances. The centre of the room is dominated by a horseshoe of battered active surfaces for the collaborative push-pull noodling. Cop space is crammed full of post-its, workflows, timeline charts, and urgent project waves. When you arrive, Dick is chatting to a knot of suits, but he clocks your availability sharpish and breaks off.
D.I. Kavanagh, he nods. In Brighton early, I see.
You register his glower, but cut him some slack. File it under up all night with no sleep. The first law of detection is the longer you leave it, the harder it is to collar the culprit. 80% of cases are solved within 48 hours, after which the probability of clear-up drops drastically. And Mac is well aware of this.
I was already past shift end when the call came in, you reply automatically.
What's turned up?
I was hoping you could shed some light on the initial contact.
His manner's abrupt.
The log here says first contact was Jason McDougal and PC Behrman. Sent to a priority 3 by control, responding to a call from a MOP, Mrs. Begum, the home help. You were in control when the call came in. What did they tell you?
That one's easy.
Nothing.
You take a cautious sip of your coffee and wince. It's bogging.
That is, I didn't take the call. I think you'll find it was Sergeant
Elvis Sorensen.
When Jace called for supervision, I was coming to the end of my shift, so I decided to visit the site in person before heading home. When I got there, Jace told me that PC Behrman took the initial contact and yanked his chain. When he got to the scene, he pulled me in, so I was the third on scene.
And then you called me immediately?
Dickie nods, his expression grim.
May I ask why you didn't file it as an accident?
Sure. Your cheek twitches. You take another mouthful of the bitter gunk from the bottom of the cafetiere. I've had dealings with Mr. Blair before. In fact, we go back a way. He's a fine, upstanding pillar of the underworld. If he'd fallen downstairs and clouted his head, I probably wouldn't have rattled your cage. But the manner of his passing was such poetic justice, so to speak.
You think it's a hit?
This is treading close to dangerous ground. Change the subject.
Let's just say, if this was my investigation, I'd want to rule that out. Did SOC do a workup on the fluid, like I suggested?
He glares at you.
How did you know?
Know what? You ask.
Then you cotton to the workflow he's fingering in cop space and grab hold of it for yourself. It flips open in all its wickified hypertextual glory, full of long medical terms that fail to signify beyond the words sildenafil and ritonavir.
Bear with me a moment while I come up to speed.
I need to look this up.
Dickie snorts. Don't bother. Sildenafil's better known as Viagra. That's nae going to do for anyone on its lonesome, but ritonavir. That's an old HIV antiviral drug. Apparently it messes up Viagra when you mix them, makes it 10 times as strong or something, and enema fluid. Apparently it's all the rage.
You've run across the enema thing before, for alcohol and other drugs, but this is a new one on you. Did he add the drugs himself, or is it a set-up?
He's HIV positive and had blood pressure issues on top. He's on ritonavir and a bunch of blood pressure meds. There's a bunch of open packets of capsules in the bathroom cabinet, but they're none of them administered by enema. The patient information for the HIV drug is full of warnings about Viagra. Not that most idiots bother reading the leaflet. And there's a bunch of empty capsule shells in the bathroom bin. And there, in a nutshell, is the veiled accusation. Murder most foul. We got a core temperature reading that suggests he was lying there since midnight the day before. I'm still waiting on the post-mortem report, but my money's on the first option. Someone who knew about Laughing Boy's dangerous habit spiked the cocktail. That machine. He points at a 3D projection of the death scene floating atop one of the surfaces. It's a collector's piece. You zoom on the thing, click through to its notes, and boggle slightly. It belonged to who? Who is apparently some VIP called Nicolae Ceaușescu, who was dictator of Romania prior to the revolution and his subsequent execution in 1989. That's crazy. The wiki goes on to say that the president for life acquired a deathly fear of germs while imprisoned during the Second World War, and consequently never wore the same clothes twice. He started every day with an enema, hence the Soviet spar equipment, which your friend Mikey subsequently acquired at auction and used for. Oh my! Talk about your hidden depths! Dickie remains dour. I ken this is new to you, but when you've finished giggling, we have a job to do. You wave it off. No, it's all right. I'm done now. You take a deep breath. Oh my. Yes. You've messaged Sally in press relations, haven't you? He nods lugubriously. It's all in process, and as soon as the post-mortem's in, I'm escalating. Liz, you kent the subject. Care to venture any speculation? What he's asking you for is strictly against the spirit of intelligence-led policing, but you're willing to cut him a lot of slack. He's 36 hours into a solid candidate for fucked-up homicide of the year, and he wouldn't be shooting the breeze with you if he had any leads. Sorry. It's all ancient history. I haven't had anything to do with Mikey since we put him away, and I don't know who his current contacts are. Have you pinged probation yet? Was he under any supervision orders? Do we have a handle on his social networks? Yes, no, and no, Liz. Well, it was worth the ask. I'll be thanking you for dropping by, and feel free to look in if you remember anything. He steers you doorwards, and you go gracefully. It wouldn't do to be cluttering up the ops room when he nails down the probable cause of death and officially escalates the investigation to murder one. And so you proceed in the general direction of your team's office, almost regretting that this is the last you'll have to do with the case. Famous last wishes. Welcome to exile. You get to your team's office through a maze of twisty passageways and a shortcut across one corner of a car park, then in through a wooden gate set in the stone wall of what used to be the police stables.
Lothian and Borders maintained a mounted unit right up until independence, at which point the drop-in demand for royal escorts sent the nags to the knackers and the budget to the UAV squadron, at which point the old stables were refurbished as accommodation for whoever lost the toss-up, meaning you and yours. The former stables are picturesque but not really fit for office work. There are no windows, except those in walls that face in on the grassy courtyard. They're cold in winter and stifling in summer, and the stone walls are a royal pain in the arse for wireless and cable ducting. On the other hand, you got esprit up to here. Everybody's got something in common to grumble about. Rather than a big open-plan briefing room with surfaces and signal strength up to 5 bars, you've got a confusing, pokey maze of thick-walled rooms lit by LED downlighters hanging from the overhead beams. And you've got a confusing, pokey maze of misfits to work with. Your department, the Innovative Crime Investigation Unit, has 4 permanent staff and another 8 part-time bodies. For your sins in a previous life, you're the inspector in charge, reporting to Chief Inspector Dixon, who wears 2 hats, CID and U-Division IT. It's not your only job, but it occupies a good 80% of your working hours. Working under you are Sergeants Cunningham and Patel, a.k.a. Moxie and Speedy, and Constable Squeaky. And they in turn train and supervise an indeterminate and ever-changing population of pawn monkeys in uniform. Welcome to the Rule 34 squad.
Morning, Skipper.
It's Moxie, squirreled away in the centre of a nest of archaic flat-panel displays, nursing a blueberry and mint latte and a ring Danish as he twitches at the incoming feeds and waves rolling up his screens.
Had a good holiday?
Not really. It's your turn to suppress a twitch.
Seen Speedy today?
Rest break. A stream in one window freezes and zooms front and centre for his attention. He forces his attention back to you, and you stifle your exasperation.
What was the question?
The rest of the force uses ICIU as a dumping ground for the weird ones. It's always like this with your team of crack ADHD poster children and borderline Aspies.
Meeting. My office, 10:30. I haven't scheduled it yet, so consider this your 1-hour reminder.
Okay. He frowns slightly, eyes flickering as he saccades between your face and the conflicting priority interrupt on screen 2.
I think.
Whatever he thinks better of it and stops. You lean past his shoulder and glance at his screen.
This is about the anomalous short tandem repeat hits on the used cartridges in the Stockbridge recycling bins, right? You think you've found something?
He makes up his mind.
Maybe, Skipper, but it's really fucking out there. Know what I mean?
Now you let out your exasperated sigh. Meeting, 10:30, remember. Have an informal report ready for me.
You straighten up.
Be seeing you.
And you beat a retreat to your office, for unlike the sergeants and constables in their cubes, you rate a solid wall of your own to bang your head against.
Rule 34. If you can imagine it, there's pornography about it on the internet. It is the generic it. Cars, mobile phones, 2 girls, 1 cup. Grotesquerie knows no limit. Originally a throwaway gag in a webcomic, popularised by the denizens of 4chan, Rule 34 has come to dominate your life. Because if you turn it on its head and start looking at the net.porn, sooner or later you have to ask, is whatever is depicted here happening on my beat? ICIU isn't about porn,
The war on porn is long since lost, though none dare admit it, so much as it's about internet memes. Random clumps of bad head meat that have climbed out of their skulls to go walkabout on the web. Often they're harmless, a craze for silly captions on cute cat photographs, but sometimes they're horrendous. And fuckwits see this stuff and think it's cool, so they imitate it. It was bad enough back in the noughties when it was just happy slappers posting videos of muggings on YouTube. These days, a meme can migrate from some cam-wearing pervert's head in the Philippines and have local copycats slashing prostitutes in Leith and Detroit and Yokohama the same day. And when you mix memes with maker culture, you have something even weirder. Everything from counterfeit pharmaceuticals through to design patterns for nightmares. Things that escape from the darker reaches of cyberspace and show up in suburban dungeons. Eldritch fads and niche cultures that have zero local history until they detonate suddenly, leaving a pile of traumatized and bleeding civilians on your doorstep. Your job is to police all this stuff, to chase it down from both ends. The online supply of designs and the meat space supply of materials that turn those designs into physical artifacts. Because of resourcing constraints, you mostly focus on the former, but it's the latter that worries you most. You log into your Surface, send out the short-notice meeting reminder to all concerned, and splat up the conference flows on all three walls around you. Then you lean back in your chair and speed-read as you try to catch up with a day out of the blogosphere. A decade and a half ago, blogging, whether writing your own or reading them on the job, would pull you a formal disciplinary hearing. Now it's part of the workload, and they grade you according to how many comments your postings get. You and about 3,000 senior ICIS professionals in other jurisdictions around the planet share the work of monitoring the net and tracking the spread of disturbing new trends. You pool the stuff your tame porn monkeys throw up, and they do likewise. There are mailing lists and chat rooms and regular face-to-face international conferences for meme cops to attend. Every week, or more frequently if necessary, you send out a bulletin for CID and U Division and everyone who needs to be aware of the latest nasty surprises. Several times a day you field puzzled inquiries from officers trying to get their heads around something that just doesn't make sense. And you've got your own investigations to run, nosing into anything ICIS dredges up that looks like it originated in your town. Cop space is all-encompassing these days, with gateways into the sprawling Interpol and Europol franchises. And your occupation is very atemporal, very post-postmodern. So, your first job of the day is to set up a query agent to look for case files containing Viagra, spammers, homicide, and enemas in close proximity. Then you add a personal note to a coordination wave asking if anyone else has seen anything relevant, tweedle a brief announcement of the facts of the case, suitably blinded, in case any of your colleagues in other jurisdictions have useful suggestions, and, on your public blog, ask if any MOPs who are in the vicinity of Mikey Blair's domain would like to drop by for tea and a chat. Only then do you get to start sifting through your regular inbox and prioritizing the day's routine workload. Item. There's a person of repeated interest in Pilton who's just turned up at the Royal Infirmary with 40 sutures in his lower back, a nasty case of MRSA, and a missing kidney. Question from CID. Do we have an organ-legging problem, or is this just punishment surgery? Item. A person of repeated interest in Crammond has been found unconscious in the gutter, sporting unusual leg injuries. Recovering in hospital, officers called to deal with a reported shooting incident took possession of the recovered projectiles. ultra-hard plastic spheres about a centimetre in diameter that show signs of having been produced on an unregistered Fabba, invisible on X-ray, which had been fired into the meniscal cartilage of each knee at point-blank range. PORI is being uncooperative. Are there reports of knee-capping using this MO elsewhere on the net? Item. We recently lifted another PORI in Craig Miller on a public order charge. IT Forensics found his phone contained numerous videos which we are treating as extreme pornography as per CJNLS 2009. A query with cause on the NPFIT database failed to identify where he downloaded this material. It certainly wasn't logged over the public internet. Query. What should we be looking for? Blacknet? Sneakernet? Or some other option? This is the problem with being on the Rule 34 squad. You get to wade through everyone else's shit, but your own case resolution metric is in the tank. For example, if you could get the resources to track down where the feedstock for that metal-hard polymer the black hats are putting through their fabbers is coming into the city from, you could follow it to the customers and shut the bastards down for a very long time indeed. Firearms Act 1968, as amended. If ICIU was classified as a support unit rather than a bastard offshoot of CID, you'd be in the clover. But it isn't. So you're expected to spend your time running dumbass web searches on behalf of the real detectives, support unit stuff, while trying to meet utterly inappropriate performance metrics for arrests and convictions. No gold star for you. On the other hand, CID can't do without the Rule 34 squad these days, doing the stuff nobody else wants to take on. So you get to keep this job so that they don't need to sit in ancient Aaron chairs all day, drinking bad coffee and staring up the goatsy-shaped ring piece of the prolapsed, ulcerous arse meat of the internet until their eyeballs melt. The members of your constantly rotating pool of internet porn monkeys typically last 3 months on the team. Then they flee screaming back to the blessed relief of patrolling the sinkhole estates and vomit-splattered pub doorways of the wrong side of town. Most of them are volunteers, officers who figure a few months off their feet in a nice warm office with a nanny-free net feed as a soft touch next to collaring Neds in Craig Miller or public order headcases off Lothian Road. Oddly, they don't often come back for a second tour of duty in Bad Head Park. A small subset are here reluctantly. You figure some of the more unscrupulous brass in E Division may be using ICIU as a punishment posting. But for you, there's no escape. The internet amplifies everything. You'd thought you'd seen the lot. You with your background in homicide and computer crime and years on the beat. You've seen rape and murder and the vileness that men and women do to one another. But the horror of their actions pales into insignificance compared to what they fantasize about. And on that note, it's just you, Moxie, Speedy and Squeaky against the scum of the internet. So, it's a blessed relief when you get to spend a day on the control center desk and an evening mopping up after a guy in a gimp suit who auto-Darwinates with extreme prejudice. Keep taking the happy pills, Liz. It's better than the alternative. Didn't you have a meeting to be going to? Your meeting rolls round, and then a lengthy chat with Chief Inspector Dixon, your boss, who mostly seems to want to catch up with the latest scuttlebutt about Dickie's dastardly deviant's demise. Prurient curiosity never goes out of fashion, even among those who ought to know better. Then an hour-long mentoring session with Speedy, who's arsing around trying to make up his mind whether to go for his PIP entry exams with an eye to making inspector some year or other.
Not totally impossible, you'll concede, but he'll have to get his shit together and focus if he's to have a hope. You attempt to put in half an hour collating the paperwork on the DNA tests on those black market feedstock canisters that have been turning up fly-tipped in residents' recycling bins, but there's nothing conclusive. It's one of those 100% under-resourced investigations that's going to go nowhere until you find something concrete to justify the resourcing without which. Lunch is a speedy bowl of microwave seitan bulgogi noodles slipped down at your desk with the door shut. Then it's on to the afternoon. First, you have a dedicated off-the-hook hour for training courseware. Then it's over to room D31 to give Dickie's DCs an off-the-cuff and off-the-record briefing on Michael Blair's colourful pre-mortem history. After which it's back to ICIU and a half-hour mentoring Constables Janie Jones and Baz McIntyre on the banality of evil, the evil of banality, how to tell the difference between faked videos and the real thing, and the best way to keep a sense of perspective while watching vids of kittens being dropped into food processors in slow-mo, or whatever else the griefers are amusing themselves with today. Sometime during the afternoon, your phone begins to shake, rattle and roll for your attention, requesting a personality change. At least, you think it began during mid-afternoon. You tend to ignore it while you're busy. When you finally get annoyed at the desperate arm-waving, you swipe the screen. It does a Jekyll and Hyde swap from its officious duty VM to your home phone's personality. You have face mail. Liz? It's Dorothy. You startle and guiltily look over your shoulder, but the door's shut. Long time no see. I'm in town again, and I was wondering if you'd like to meet up. I'm free tonight, if that's convenient, or we could talk. Well, that's a turn-up. But it also upends all your carefully controlled tranquility. You and Dorothy have history. Or herstory. Your heart beats faster for a moment, the phone clammy in your palm. You stop. Talking to voicemail? Ungood. You text her back, quickly, suggesting meeting up in a friendly wine bar in the new town. Then you take a deep breath and swipe your phone back to its on-duty persona. You take another deep breath as you try to gather your scattered thoughts. You're not sure how you feel about this. It's been months, hasn't it? But suddenly you feel almost hopeful, which is bad because you're meant to be on duty. So you turn back to the waves and streams of ICIS chatter and see Carl at Dresden, DE, 1556-100 hours. Hi, guys. We have a weird one here today. One of our local lowlifes tried to off himself in a really original way, we think. Perp owns a fancy suntanning bed. Don't ask. Apparently, there is a common software hack to override the 10-minute maximum exposure and tanning intensity limits, and he drank half a bottle of schnapps spiked with oxazepam before getting in. Not sure why. Anyway, third-degree radiation burns to 95% of body. Man, those UVA LEDs are scary. There is rumour about tanning and street drugs producing endorphin high. Are any similar reports? You're not sure just what it is that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up, but you sit there and stare at the transcript for a long moment, then airtype. Query. What is Perp's background? It's a minute or so before Carl spots your addition and replies, during which time you're perusing a report on trends in toxicant inhalation among youth in the seedier Parisian banlieues. Then, Perp is a scam artist, bulk mailing fraud and tax evasion. Why? Your fingers shaking, you reply, maybe nothing, but we have a weird one here too. Our Perp had a record, pharmaceutical spam,
illegal sale of medicinal products, counterfeit goods. We're investigating it as murder due to circumstances of death.
More waiting.
What circumstances?
At this point, you pause to authenticate Carl's identity credentials. Carl Heiner is indeed an officer of some kind in the Kriminalpolizei in Dresden, according to your departmental authentication server. He is, in the loosest possible sense, one of your colleagues. But on the other hand, you check the department newsfeed for confirmation, Dicky has indeed escalated the case of the late Mr. Blair to murder in the first degree as of lunchtime, and the ironclad rule of criminal intelligence is assimilate everything, disclose nothing. You think for another minute, then...
I am not principal investigator. Suggest you contact DCI McLeish, profile attached, for further information. Tell him I noted circumstantial similarity. Bye.
At which point you could wash your hands of the whole affair and consider your duty done, but that's not enough, is it? You stare at Carl's note for a full minute, letting it all percolate together, trying to quantify your sense of déjà vu. Item. Perp is a spammer. Item. Perp is found dead in a weird and improbable accident at home. Item. Rogue domestic appliances are implicated. Item. So are inappropriate intoxicating substances.
Nah, that never happens, not in real life outside of the movies.
Does it?
Dicky will think I'm off my trolley, you mutter to yourself. Then you pick up your phone, shake it, and speed dial.
Chief Inspector, if I can have a moment.
Really? That's too bad. Listen, I don't want to add to your workload, but I have a possible lead from...
It's a long shot. Germany?
Yes, it's intelligence-led. They've got a circumstantially similar case on their hands in the past 24 hours.
No, not exactly the same, but I spotted at least 4 points of similarity.
So far, no. They're still treating it as accidental but weird.
No, I know. I told him I'm not the lead, gave him your details.
Yes, I'm sorry, but in my judgment there's something very fishy about it, and I think you need to talk to the man.
No.
Look, you know what I do, don't you? I'm here to watch for... Well, shit!
You put the phone down carefully in case it explodes, or maybe in case you explode. Anger management is one of those compulsory people skills, Hingham is, they put you through on a regular basis. Clearly Dick is overdue for his next refresher. You can fully appreciate how busy he is and how he's got the brass breathing down his neck. Scotland, as a nation, gets about 100 murders a year, but Edinburgh accounts for less than a tenth of that. And you know this is but a circumstantial what-the-fuck indicator, most likely a coincidence. But there's no call to bite your head off. If Dicky doesn't want to carry it, he can always fob you off on one of his minions. There's absolutely no fucking call to swear at a fellow officer like that, much less a sometime classmate. And it is indicative of a distinct lack of respect and professionalism, and you have half a mind to...
No, scratch that. Leaves the formal complaint for some other time, when he isn't being shat on from above and trying to juggle a murder investigation and his regular caseload. Now isn't the time to go nuclear, whether or not Dicky deserves it. You've had years of practice at swallowing this shit. Often as not, they don't even realise they're dishing it out. Coming from a macho subculture, gobbling pints and proton pump inhibitors to keep their stomachs from exploding with all the bile and suppressed rage that goes with a job. No, just no. Bottle it up for later.
And speaking of bottling it, you put in 3.5 hours of overtime yesterday. It's 40 minutes to end of shift right now, and if you don't claw back some personal space, HR will notice and send you on a mandatory work/rest chakra rebalancing course again,
because the New Age hippie counselling shit is cheaper than paying for stress-related sick leave. Anyway, haven't you got a date? It's time to go home and shower, then off to the wine bar to see what Dorothy wants, whether it's you or just a familiar face in a strange town. And to maybe bring down the wall and get comfortably numb for a few hours before you climb back into the broken hamster wheel of your career and scamper round again and again. Maybe you didn't know it at the time, but you and Dorothy have been friends for, oh, ever so long. Since maybe back before you were in primary two, and Miss Simpson started in on the utterly bowdlerised sex ed coursework, which was all they were allowed to hand out back then. Back in the early 90s, in the dog days of Section 28, the part of the Local Government Act that banned local councils and education authorities from admitting that homosexuality even existed, much less allowing teachers to tell isolated kids that being destined for the Adam and Steve alternative didn't mean they were pariahs or perverts. Back then, even aged 8, you'd figured out for yourself that this stuff was all wrong. You'll never get me to do that with a boy. Well, maybe, but why bother? It's an awful lot of hard work, and no little mess, for something that doesn't look much like anything you'd call fun. On the other hand, that was before you hit your teens and ran into crushes and BFFs and all the weirdly incomprehensible playground politics that never really made sense to you. Because your crushes were all wrong, and you were afraid to talk about them. "Is she a lesbo?" was about the second worst thing they could say about anyone, and you knew that if you gave them even a hint about what you dreamed about what made you wake flushed and sweating in the small hours, it'd be the absolute end, utter humiliation for the rest of your life. So you giggled along with them and learned to lie, didn't admit to watching and re-watching Xena on video until the tapes chewed themselves up, and made a point of going to church so that when you said you believed in no sex before marriage, they believed you and forgot to ask the obvious follow-on question. So, who's the lucky boy then? You even did the Alpha course when you were 18 and lied enthusiastically right up until the speaking in tongues bit, which caught in your throat. But then it was time for university, where you met your inner Dorothy and got to know her quite well. Learning who you are is something every teenager goes through, but if your identity isn't an identikit match for any of the role models on offer, it can take quite a while and take you up some strange paths on the way. You figured out you wanted to be a cop quite early. Maybe it was Uncle Bert's fault, even though he never bothered taking the sergeant's exam, and maybe it was connected to the hard-shell uniformed image. Self-sufficient, justified, not taking shit from ignorant assholes. You wanted that, you wanted it badly, and you believed in rules and telling the truth and punishing bullies. But maybe there was something else going on as well, something you didn't understand at the time. When you got your A-level grades and that place at university and broke away from the hometown claustrophobia for the first time, you didn't bother joining any wishy-washy clubs and societies. You signed up for archery and scuba diving rather than the feminist society or LGBT society. You did your drinking in a pub on the wrong side of the tracks, where you unconsciously felt safe, not realising that you were missing out on all the torrid fleshpots of academia. And it was from the local bears that you learned about gay culture at second hand. Learned their jokes, learned their slang, learned Friends of Dorothy as archaic code for the love that dared not speak its name, once upon a time. You never realised that the Feminist Society was the bed-hopping club of your dreams, or that if you'd hung out in the Students' Union on campus, you could have had your
pick from the conveyor belt sushi buffet of dungaree-wearing baby dykes in LGBT society. At least until they learned you were studying to be a cop. Mary was the turning point. Portsmouth, Pompey, a naval town going back hundreds of years. And where you get warships, you get sailors. Some of whom, you can imagine Kylie in Lower Sixth hissing it in disbelief, were lesbians, who did not hang out around the university campus, but were certainly willing to take a gawky post-teen with aspirations towards a uniformed service under their wings and teach her stuff about herself that would be a source of nostalgia many years later. Mary was blonde and friendly and brisk, and for a while you'd been her girl in port, which was good while it lasted. 12 months, 18, and left you on a tide of tears, clutching a much better understanding of who you were going to be when you grew up. All of which is 15 years and more in your past, but goes some way towards explaining how you got a boner grip on Polari before anybody told you that you were the wrong kind of feminist. Why you sigh whenever you see a navy ship in the waters of the Firth, and how come you think it's hilarious that your on-again-off-again will-she-or-won't-she-nuisance lover is called Dorothy Strait.